And nearly all the Greeks, one might say, made use of the dog, and some still do, as a victim for purifications. And they carry out puppies for Hecate along with the other purificatory offerings, and they wipe those who need to be cleansed with puppies, calling this kind of purification paraskilakismos. Or is it that the wolf lupus is lupus, and the lupercalia are the lycia? And since the dog is hostile to the wolf, it is for this reason sacrificed at the lycia. Or is it because the dogs in the city bark at the lupersi and harass them as they run about? Or is the sacrifice made to Pan, and is the dog dear to Pan on account of the flocks of goats? Why, at the festival called the Septimontium, did they take care not to use yoked vehicles, and why do those today who do not despise the customs of the ancients still observe this? They date the Septimontium from the fact that a seventh district was added to the city and Rome became a city of seven hills. Is it, as some of the Roman antiquarians suppose, because the city had not yet been completely joined together in all its parts? Or rather, this has nothing to do with Dionysus. But since the great work of the union of the settlements had been accomplished, they thought that the city, having reached this point, had ceased its forward growth, and so they gave themselves a rest and rested also the draft animals that had labored with them, and allowed them to enjoy the leisure of the common festival. Or did they wish always to adorn and honor every festival with the citizens' presence, and especially the one held in celebration of the city's union? In order, then, that they might not leave the city whose festival it was it not permitted to make use of teams that day? Why do they call those condemned for theft or certain other servile offenses furciferi? Is this too a proof of the diligence of the ancients? For when a household slave had been convicted of some misdeed of his own, the master would order him to take up the double piece of wood which they place under wagons, and carry it about, in full view of everyone, through the neighborhood or the quarter, so that people would distrust him and be on their guard against him for the future. This piece of wood we call a prop, but the Romans call it a furca, and hence the man who has carried it about is called furcifer. Why do they tie hay to the horn of budding oxen to warn anyone who meets them to be on guard? Is it because from repletion and excess of feeding oxen and horses and asses, and even men grow insolent and wanton? As Sophocles somewhere has put it, but you kick up your heels like a colt well fed, for your belly and your jaw are full. That is why the Romans said that Marcus Crassus had hay on his horn, for those who tore at others in the political arena were on their guard against him, as a man dangerous and hard to attack. Later, however, it was said again that Caesar had taken the hay from Crassus, for Caesar was the first to stand up against him in politics and to show contempt for him. Why did the priests concerned with divination by birds, whom they formerly called auspices, but now call augurs, think it necessary that their lanterns always be open and their lids not put on? Is it that, just as the Pythagoreans made small things symbols of great ones, forbidding people to sit on a grain measure and not to stir the fire with a knife, so too the ancients made use of many such riddling precepts, especially in dealing with priests, of which the precept about the lantern is one. For the lantern resembles the body that encloses the soul, since the light within is like the soul, and the intelligent and prudent part of it must always be kept open and clear-sighted, and never shut up or stifled. Now when there are winds, the birds are unsteady and give no reliable signs, on account of their wandering and irregular flight. The custom, then, teaches that the augurs should go about their observations not when there are winds, but when there is calm and settled weather, since it is then that they are able to use their lanterns open. Why, again, was it forbidden for priests who had a sore to sit as observers of the auspices? Is this too a symbol, that those who deal with divine matters should have nothing gnawing at them, no sore of their own, so to speak, and no distress of soul, but should be free from grief, whole, and undistracted? Or is it simply reasonable, since one would not use for sacrifice a victim that had a sore, nor birds for augury that had one, that priests should guard against such things in themselves even more, and, having become pure and unharmed and whole, should proceed to the signs given by the gods? For a sore seems to be a kind of mutilation and defilement of the body. Why did King Servius Tullius found a shrine of Fortuna Parva, which they call Brevis? Is it because, being small and engaged in humble occupations, and born of a captive mother, he came by fortune to reign over Rome? Or does this change rather display the greatness of fortune than her smallness, and did Servius, more than anyone, seemed to deify the power of fortune and to ascribe to her every one of his actions. For he built shrines not only to Fortune of Good Hope, and Fortune Averter of Evil, and Gentle Fortune, and Fortune Firstborn, and Manly Fortune, but there is also a shrine of Private Fortune, another of Fortune Who Returns, another of Virgin Fortune. And why should one go on to list her other epithets, when there is even a shrine of Fortune the Fowler, whom they call Viscata, as though we were caught by her from afar and made to cling fast to affairs? Consider, then, whether he had observed how great is the power that fortune always exercises through small things, and how it has often happened to some that through a small thing happening or not happening they gained or missed the greatest prizes. And so he founded a shrine of Fortuna Parva, teaching men to attend to their affairs and not to despise, because of their smallness, the things that come their way. Why did they not extinguish a lamp, but let it die out of its own accord? Is it because they reverenced it as kindred to and akin to the unquenchable and immortal fire? Or is this too a symbol that one ought not to destroy or take the life of a living thing, if it does no harm, since fire resembles a living creature? For indeed it needs nourishment and moves of itself, and when quenched gives off a sound as though it were being killed. Or does the custom teach us that we ought not to destroy in utter excess fire or water or any other necessity, when we ourselves have enough of it, but should allow those in need to use it, and leave it for others, when we ourselves no longer have need of it? Why do those thought to excel in noble birth wear crescent moons on their shoes? Is it, as Castor says, a symbol of the dwelling said to be on the moon, and of the belief that after death souls will again have the moon beneath their feet? Or did this belong as a special privilege to the most ancient people, who were Arcadians of the race descended from Evander, called Proslenians? Or, like many other things, does this too remind those who are elated and think too highly of themselves of the vicissitude that befalls human affairs in both directions, taking the moon as their example? How it first comes from obscurity, a new face, growing more beautiful and filling out, and then, just when it appears at its fairest, wastes away again and comes to nothing? Or was it a lesson in obedience that those who live under kings should not chafe, but like the moon, should be willing to attend upon the greater power and always take the second rank, gazing toward the rays of the sun, as Parmenides says, so being content with the second place, while enjoying the power and honor that come from the ruler? Why do they reckon the year as belonging to Zeus, but the months to Hera? Is it because of the invisible and intelligible gods, Zeus and Hera are king and queen, while of the visible gods the sun and moon hold that place? And the sun makes the year, while the moon makes the months. But one must not think of these simply as images of those higher gods, but that Zeus himself is, in matter, the sun, and Hera herself is, in matter, the moon. That is why they call Hera Juno, the name signifying the young or the younger, taking it from the moon, and they call Hera Lucina, as it were the bright one or she who gives light, and believe that she assists at childbirth and labor pains, just as the moon does through the dark vault of the stars, through the swift-bearing moon, for they think that women give birth most easily at the full moon. Why is the bird called the left bird considered auspicious? Is this in fact not true, but is the common speech misleading many? For they call left sinistrum, and to let go they call signer and sign, using these words when they bid one let something go. So the bird that lets a course of action go, being sinisterious, is wrongly taken by most people for sinistrum, and so named. Or is it, as Dionysius says, that when a flash of lightning-bringing victory occurred on the left as Ascanius, son of Aeneas, was drawn up in battle against Mezentius, they took it as an omen and have observed the custom accordingly ever since? Or, as others say, because this happened to Aeneas himself. And indeed the Thebans, after routing and defeating the enemy with their left wing at Leuctra, continued in all their battles thereafter to give the place of command to the left. Or rather, as Juba says, for those who face the rising sun, the north falls on the left, which some reckon to be the right and superior side of the universe. Consider, however, whether it is not that, since the left side is naturally the weaker, those who preside over the auspices thereby, as it were, strengthen and support it, making up for its deficiency of power. Or that, believing earthly and mortal things to be opposed to heavenly and divine ones, they supposed that the gods send what is on our left from their own right. Why was it permitted, Once a man who had celebrated a triumph had died and been cremated, to take a bone of his and carry it into the city and deposit it there, as Pyrrho of Lipara has recorded. Is it in honor of the dead man? For indeed to other men of distinction, and to generals they granted burial in the forum, not only for themselves, but for their descendants after them, as to Valerius and Fabricius. And they say that when the descendants of these men die and are brought to the forum, a burning torch is lowered toward them, and then at once removed, they making use of the honor without arousing envy, and only establishing the right to do so. Why, when they entertained triumphant generals at a public banquet, did they excuse the consuls, and send word asking them not to come to the dinner? Is it because the place of honor at table had to be given to the man who had triumphed, along with an escort home after dinner, and this could not be granted to another while the consuls were present, but only to him? Why does the tribune of the people not wear the purple-bordered robe, though the other magistrates do? Is it because he is not, strictly speaking, a magistrate at all? For tribunes have no lictors, nor do they conduct business seated on the curule chair, nor do they enter office at the beginning of the year as all the other magistrates do, nor do they cease to hold office when a dictator is chosen, though he transfers to himself every other office, but they alone remain, as though they were not magistrates, but held some other kind of position. Just as some orators do not wish the plebeian bar to be counted a form of suit, since it acts in a manner opposite to a suit, for the one brings a case in and produces a judgment, the other does away with and dissolves one, in the same way they think the tribunate is more a check upon office, and a stand taken against office than an office itself. For to resist the power of a magistrate, and to strip away his excessive authority is itself a form of authority and power. One might say this and other such things, using mere cleverness of argument. But since the tribunate derives its origin from the people, its popular character is a strong one, and it counts for much that the tribune should not think more highly of himself than the rest, but should make himself like the ordinary citizens he encounters in bearing, dress, and way of life. For pomp befits a consul or a praetor, but the tribune, as Gaius Curio used to say, ought to be trodden underfoot, and should not be solemn in appearance, nor difficult of access, nor harsh to the many, but easy for the people to deal with, though he stands up for others. Hence it is the custom that the door of his house is never shut, but stands open both night and day, like a harbor and refuge for those in need. And the more he lowers himself in outward show, the more he grows in actual power. For they hold him, by virtue of his usefulness, to be common and accessible to all, like an altar, while by the honor paid him they make him sacred, holy, and inviolable, so that wherever he walks in public, it is the law for all to purify and cleanse their persons as though they had been defiled. Why are the rods of the praetors carried bound together with the axes fastened to them? Is it because this is a symbol that the anger of the ruler ought not to be quick and unrestrained? And the delay and postponement caused by loosening the rods, one by one and slowly, has often made him change his mind about the punishment. And since some wrongdoing is curable and some incurable, the rods admonish what is capable of being reformed, while the axes cut off what cannot be admonished. Why, when they learned that the barbarians called the Blesionii had sacrificed a human being to the gods, did they send for their magistrates intending to punish them? But when it appeared that they had done this in accordance with some law of theirs, released them, though forbidding it for the future. Yet not many years before this, they themselves had buried alive two men and two women in the place called the Cattle Market, two Greeks and two Gauls. It seems strange that they should do this themselves, while reproaching the barbarians for doing what is unholy. Is it that they considered it unholy to sacrifice human beings to the gods, but necessary to do so for the demons? Or did they think that those who did this as a matter of custom and law were doing wrong, while they themselves acted only because commanded by the Sibylline books? For it is said that a certain maiden, Helvia, riding on horseback, was struck by lightning, and the horse was found lying stripped, and she herself naked, her tunic drawn up as though on purpose from her private parts, while her shoes, rings, and hairnet were scattered about apart from one another, and her tongue was thrust out of her mouth. When the seers declared that this portended a terrible disgrace for the sacred virgins, one that would become notorious, and that some outrage would also touch the knights, the slave of a certain barbarian horseman, gave information against three maidens. Three of the Vestal virgins, Emilia, Licinia, and Marcia, who had all been corrupted at the same time and had long consorted with men, one of whom was Butetius, a barbarian, the master of the informer. Those women were convicted and punished, but since the deed seemed so dreadful, it was resolved that the priests should consult the Sibylline books. And it is said that oracles were found which not only foretold that these things portended evil, but also prescribed that, to avert the coming disaster, two Greeks and two Gauls should be buried alive on the spot. Why do they reckon the beginning of the day from the middle of the night? Is it because the state's constitution was originally a military one, and most useful operations in campaigns are begun beforehand, at night? Or did they make the sunrise the beginning of action, but the night the beginning of preparation? For one must make one's preparations and then act, not act while still preparing, as Meissen is said to have told Chillon the Sage, when Meissen was building a winnowing fan in the middle of winter. Or, just as midday is, for most people, the limit for transacting public and serious business, so they thought it fitting to make midnight the beginning of the day. A strong proof of this is the fact that a Roman magistrate does not conclude treaties or agreements after midday. Or is it impossible to take sunset and sunrise as the beginning and end of the day? For if, as most people do, we mark by sense perception the beginning of day as the first appearance of the sun and the end of night as its final disappearance, we shall not get an equinox. Rather, the night which we suppose to be most nearly equal to the day will appear shorter than the day, because of the size of the sun's disk. And this is the very absurdity that the astronomers, in turn, try to cure by positing that the moment when the sun's center touches the horizon marks the boundary of day and night. But this does away with plain observation. For it will follow that, while much light still remains above the earth and the sun is still shining upon us, we must agree that it is not yet day, but still night. Since then, at the rising and setting of the sun, the beginning of the day is hard to fix. For the reasons stated, what is left is to take as the beginning either the moment the sun is at the zenith or the moment it is at the nadir. The second is the better choice. For from midday the sun moves away from us toward its setting, but from midnight it moves toward us, toward its rising. Why in old times did they not allow women to grind grain or cook? Is it because they were mindful of the pact they made with the Sabines? For after they had seized the Sabines' daughters and then made peace with them after the war, this term too was written into the other agreements, that no Roman wife should grind grain for her husband or do the cooking. Why do they not marry women in the month of May? Is it because May falls between April and June, of which the one is sacred to Aphrodite and the other to Hera, both gods of marriage, and out of reverence they either take their weddings a little earlier or wait a little later? Or is it because in this month they perform their greatest rite of purification, nowadays throwing effigies from the bridge into the river, but in ancient times throwing in men? For this reason, the Flaminica, who is held to be a priestess of Hera, is required by custom to look sorrowful and neither to bathe nor to adorn herself at that time. Or is it because many of the Latins in this month make offerings to the dead, and for that reason perhaps they also worship Hermes in it, since it is named after Maya? Or, as some say, is the month of Maius named from the elder, and Junius from the younger, age of life? And the young is more suited to marriage, as Euripides too says. Old age dismisses Aphrodite gladly, and Aphrodite is displeased with the old. They do not marry, then, in May, but wait for June, which comes immediately after May. Why do they part the hair of brides with the point of a spear? Is this a symbol of the fact that the first women were married by force and through war? Or do they thus learn, in living with warlike and martial men, to accept an unadorned, unsoftened, and simple style of beautification? Just as Lycurgus, by ordering that doors and roofs for houses be made only with saw and axe, and that no other tool be used at all, banished every kind of elaborateness and extravagance. Or does what is done hint at the separation to come, as if the marriage were to be dissolved by iron alone? Or is it rather that most matters concerning marriage were attached to Hera, and the spear is held sacred to Hera, and most of her statues are supported by a spear, and the goddess is surnamed Quiritis, for the ancients called the spear Curis, and hence they say that any alias too was named Quirinus. Why do they call what is performed for public shows Lucar? Is it because there are many groves dedicated to the gods around the city, which they call Lucii, and they used to spend the revenue from these on the shows? Why do they call the Quirinalia the Festival of Fools? Is it because, as Juba says, they had assigned this day to those who did not know their own curia, or rather to those who, unlike the rest, had not sacrificed by tribes at the Fornicalia, whether through preoccupation or absence or ignorance, and so this day was given them to make up for that festival? Why, when a sacrifice is made to Heracles, do they name no other god and no dog is seen within the precincts, as Varro has recorded? Is it that they name no other god because they consider him a demigod? And as some say, while Heracles was still living among men, Evander set up an altar to him and offered sacrifice. But of all animals, he was most at war with the dog, for this creature caused him a great deal of trouble, both Cerberus himself, and on top of everything, when Oenus, son of Licymnius, was killed by the sons of Hippocoon because of a dog, he was forced to join battle and lost, along with many other friends, his own brother Iphicles. Why were the patricians not permitted to dwell around the capital? Is it because Marcus Manlius, who lived there, attempted a tyranny, on whose account it is said to be forbidden by oath for any man of the house of the Manlii to bear the name Marcus? Or was this an old fear? At any rate, they never ceased maligning Publicola, a man most devoted to the people, the powerful slandering him, the many fearing him, because his house seemed to overhang the forum, until he himself tore it down. Why do they give an oaken crown to the man who has saved a fellow citizen in war? Is it because oak can be found everywhere and easily on campaign, or because the crown is sacred to Zeus and Hera, whom they consider protectors of the city? Or is this an ancient custom from the Arcadians, who have some kinship with the oak tree? For they are held to be the first of men to have sprung from the earth, just as the oak is the first of plants. Why do they use vultures above all for taking auspices? Is it because 12 vultures also appeared to Romulus at the founding of Rome, or because this bird is the least familiar and the least accustomed to human company of all birds? For it is not easy even to come across a vulture's nest. Rather, they descend suddenly from somewhere far off, which is why their appearance is regarded as significant. Or did they learn this too from Heracles, if Herodorus speaks truly when he says that Heracles rejoiced more than at any other omen when vultures appeared at the outset of an undertaking, holding the vulture to be the most righteous of all flesh-eating creatures? For first, it does not touch anything living, nor does it kill any living creature, as eagles and hawks and the night-hunting birds do, but makes use only of things that have died in some other way. And further, it even spares creatures of its own kind. No one has ever seen a vulture feeding on a bird, whereas eagles and hawks, above all, pursue and strike their own kin, and yet, as Aeschylus says, how could bird be pure that feeds on bird? And toward men, so to speak, it is the most harmless of creatures, destroying neither crop nor plant nor any tame animal. But if, as the Egyptians relate in their myths, the whole race is female, and they conceive by taking in the east wind as it blows upon them, just as trees conceive from the west wind, then it is plausible that the signs derived from them are entirely unerring and reliable. In the case of other birds, on the other hand, the flutterings, and further the snatchings and flights and pursuits connected with mating, produce a great deal of confusion and disorder. Why is the temple of Asclepius outside the city? Is it because they considered dwelling outside healthier than dwelling within the town? Indeed, the Greeks too have their sanctuaries of Asclepius situated, as a rule, in clean and elevated places. Or is it because they believe the god came summoned from Epidaurus? And at Epidaurus too, the sanctuary of Asclepius is not within the city but some way off. Or is it because, when the serpent disembarked from the trireme onto the island and disappeared, they thought the god himself was indicating where his temple should be founded? Why is it customary for those observing ritual purity to abstain from legumes? Is it, as the Pythagoreans held, that they consecrated beans as forbidden for the reasons commonly given, and likewise the vetch and the chickpea, as being named after Erebus and Lethe? Or is it because legumes are used above all for funeral banquets and for invocations of the dead? Or rather is it because for acts of purification and holiness, the body must be kept clean and light. And legumes are gas-producing and create surplus matter, requiring a great deal of purging. Or is it also because, on account of their windy and flatulent nature, they stir one towards sexual intercourse? Why do they not punish in the ordinary way those of the all-holy virgins who have been corrupted, but instead bury them alive? Is it because they cremate the dead, and it was not right to bury with fire one who had not piously kept the divine fire? Or did they consider it not lawful to destroy a body that had been consecrated to the greatest rites of holiness, or to lay hands upon a sacred woman? And so, contriving that she die by her own agency, they brought her down under the earth into a chamber that had been built, where a lamp lay burning and bread, and a little milk and water. Then they covered the chamber over with earth from above. And not even in this way, having performed the rite, have they escaped superstition. But even to this day, the priests go to the place and offer expiatory rites there. Why, when a horse race is held at the Ides of December, is the winning right-hand tracehorse sacrificed to Mars, while someone cuts off its tail and carries it to the place called the Regia and sprinkles the altar with the blood, while over its head men coming down from what is called the sacred way fight it out with men from the Subura? Is it, as some say, that they punish the horse because they believe Troy was captured by means of a horse, seeing that they themselves are the splendid offspring of Trojans mixed with the children of the Latins? Or is it because the horse is a spirited, warlike, and martial creature, and they sacrifice to the gods the things that are dearest and most fitting to them, and the winner is sacrificed because the god is associated with victory and mastery? Or rather is it because the god's work is a matter of standing firm, and those who hold their ground in formation defeat those who do not hold it but flee? And so speed is punished as an accessory to cowardice, and men learn symbolically that there is no safety for those who flee. Why, when the censors take up office, do they do nothing else before letting out the contract for feeding the sacred geese and gilding the statue? Is it because they begin from the least costly matters, which require neither much expense nor much trouble? Or is this an ancient gratitude remembered toward these creatures on account of the Gauls? Because, when the barbarians were already climbing over the wall of the capital by night while the dogs slept, the geese noticed and roused the guards with their cries. Or is it that the censors, being guardians of the greatest matters, and it being fitting for them to oversee and busy themselves with sacred and public affairs, with lives, characters, and modes of living, immediately take account of the most watchful of animals, and at the same time, by their care for these creatures, exhort the citizens not to neglect or grow careless about sacred things? And the gilding of the statue is necessary, since the red pigment with which the ancient statues used to be colored quickly fades. Why, when they suspend other priests who have been condemned and gone into exile and choose another in their place, do they not, in the case of the augur, take away the priesthood even if he is convicted of the greatest crimes, so long as he lives, though they call those who deal with omens augurs? Is it, as some say, that they wish no one who is not a priest to know the secrets of the priesthood? Or, since the augur is bound by oaths never to reveal the secrets of the sacred rites to anyone, are they unwilling to release him from those oaths by making him a private citizen? Or is augur not the name of an honor or an office at all, but of a branch of knowledge and skill? The augur, then, is like a musician or a physician. Forbidding a diviner to be a diviner by voting him out is like disqualifying a musician from being a musician or a physician from being a physician, men unable to take away his actual skill, even if they take away his title. And they do not appoint another in his place, quite reasonably keeping the original number of augurs. Why, on the Ides of August, which used to be called the Sextilian Ides, do all the female and male slaves hold festival, and the women especially make a practice of washing and cleansing their heads? Is it because King Servius was born on this day, of a captive maidservant, and so the household slaves have license from their labors, and the practice of washing heads, having begun with the maidservants because of the festival, spread even to the freeborn? Why do they adorn boys with the neck ornaments they call bully? Is it in honor of the ravished women, as with many other customs? And did they vote that this too should belong to the children born of them? Or is it in honor of the manly courage of Tarquin? For it is said that, While still a boy, in the battle against the Latins together with the Etruscans, he charged into the enemy. And when thrown from his horse, he stood his ground boldly against those bearing down on him and rallied the Romans. And when a brilliant rout of the enemy followed, with 16,000 slain, he received this as a prize of valor from his father and king. Or is it that among the ancients, while it was not disgraceful or shameful for men to love slave boys who were in their prime, as the comedies even now attest, they strongly abstained from freeborn boys, and so that men might not mistake them even if they met them naked, the boys wore this distinguishing badge? Or is it also a safeguard against disorderly conduct, and in a way a bridle upon licentiousness, since boys were ashamed to become men before laying aside the badge of childhood? What the school of Varro says is not persuasive, that, since the bulla was called bala by the Aeolians, the boys wore it as a symbol of good counsel, eubolia. But watch that they do not also wear it on account of the moon. The visible shape of the moon, when it is at the full, is not spherical but lens-shaped and disc-shaped, as Empedocles also supposes it to be in its underlying nature. Why do they give names to boys on the ninth day after birth, but to girls on the eighth? Is it that for females the earlier day has its cause in nature? For the female grows, reaches its prime, and is completed sooner than the male. As for the days, they take those after the seventh, for the seventh day is a dangerous one for newborns, both in other respects and with regard to the navel. Most infants have the cord detach on the seventh day, and until it does, the infant resembles a plant more than an animal. Or is it rather, as the Pythagoreans held, that of numbers the even is female and the odd is male? For the odd is generative and prevails over the even when combined with it. And when numbers are divided into their units, the even, like the female, yields an empty space between them, whereas of the odd a part always remains full. Hence they consider the one suited to the male, the other to the female. Or is it because, of all numbers, 9 is the first square derived from 3, an odd and perfect number, while 8 is the first cube derived from 2, an even number? The man ought to be square, odd, and perfect, while the woman, like the cube, ought to be steady, keeping to the house, and hard to move. To this must be added that 8 is a cube from the dyad, while 9 is a square from the triad, and women use 2 names, but men 3. Why do they call fatherless sons spuriae? It is not, as the Greeks suppose and as their orators say in the law courts, because they are born of some mixed and common seed. Rather, spurious is one of the first names, like Sextus, Decimus, and Gaius. Now the first names they do not write out in full, but either with one letter as Titus, Lucius, and Marcus, or with two as Tiberius and Gnaeus, or with three as Sextus and Servius. Spurius, then, is among those written with two letters, S and P, and with these same letters they also write, for fatherless children, sign patter, that is, without a father, the S signifying sign and the P signifying patter. This, then, gave rise to the error that sign patter and spurious are written with the same letters. One must also mention the other account, which is more far-fetched. They say that the Sabines call a woman's genitals spurium, and then, as if in mockery, call by this name a child born of an unmarried and unbetrothed woman. Why do they call Dionysus Liber Pater? Is it because he becomes, for those who drink, a father of freedom? For most people grow bold and are filled with frankness of speech in their cups. Or is it because he furnished the libation? Or, as Alexander says, is it from Eleutherae in Boeotia, after which Dionysus is called Eleutherius? For what reason is it not customary at public festivals for virgins to be married, though widows are married then? Is it, as Varro has said, because virgins are married with grief while women who remarry rejoice, and at a festival one ought to do nothing under compulsion or in grief? Or rather is it because for virgins it is honorable to be sought by not a few suitors, while for widows, since many seek them, it is shameful to marry amid such numbers? For a first marriage is enviable, but a second is something to be prayed against. Women are ashamed to take another husband while the first still lives, and they lament if he has died. Hence, they prefer quiet to noise and processions, and festivals draw the crowd away so that people have no leisure for such things. Or is it because, when they seized the daughters of the Sabines while they were virgins at a festival and thereby brought on war, they took this as an omen against marrying virgins on sacred days? Why do the Romans worship Fortuna Primigenia, which one might call, firstborn fortune? Is it because it was by fortune, as they say, that Servius, born of a slave woman, came to reign over Rome with distinction? For so most Romans call it, with distinction. Or rather, is it because fortune furnished Rome's very beginning and origin? Or does the matter admit a more natural and more philosophical explanation, namely that fortune is the origin of all things, and that nature itself arises out of what comes to be by chance, whenever order comes upon things that had been randomly disposed? Why do the Romans call the performers associated with Dionysus Histrians? Is it for the reason that Cluvius Rufus has recorded? For he says that in very ancient times, when Gaius Sulpicius and Licinius Stola were consuls, a plague occurred in Rome that killed indiscriminately all who came forward onto the stage. When the Romans sent for help, many skilled performers came from Etruria, and the one among them who was most esteemed and who enjoyed the longest success on the stage was named Histor. And it is on account of him, they say, that all such performers came to be called Histrians. Why do they not marry close relatives? Is it because, wishing to extend their family connections through marriage, they sought to acquire many kinsmen by giving their women to others and receiving women from others in turn? Or is it because they feared the disputes that arise in marriages between relatives, since such quarrels would destroy even the ties that are naturally just between them? Or is it that, seeing how much help wives need on account of their weakness, they were unwilling to marry them to close relations, so that if their husbands should wrong them, their own kinsmen would be there to help them? Why was the priest of Jupiter, whom they call the Flamen Dialys, not permitted to touch flour or leaven? Is it because flour is an incomplete and unconcocted food? For the wheat has neither remained what it was, nor yet become what it must become, namely bread. Rather, it has lost the generative power of the seed while not yet acquiring the usefulness of food. Hence the poet, by a figure of speech, called barley groats, ground by the mill, as though it were something slain and destroyed in the grinding. Leaven, too, arises out of a kind of corruption, and itself corrupts the dough with which it is mixed, for it becomes weak and enervated, and fermentation seems altogether to resemble putrefaction. Indeed, in excess it turns entirely sour and spoils the flour. Why is the priest also forbidden to touch raw flesh? Is it that the custom turns him far away from raw eating altogether, or is it for the same reason that they hold flour to be forbidden that they also treat meat as unhallowed? For it is no longer a living creature, nor yet has it become food. Boiling and roasting are a kind of alteration and transformation that change its form, but what is fresh and raw does not even present a clean and unsullied appearance, but rather one that is repulsive and wound-like. Why did they order the priest to abstain from dog and goat, neither touching them nor even naming them? Is it that they abhorred the goat for its lechery and foul smell, or that they feared its liability to disease? For of all animals, the goat is thought most subject to seizure by epilepsy, and to communicate the affliction to those who eat or touch it while it is in the grip of the malady. They say the cause is a frequent narrowing of its breathing passages, inferring this from the thinness of its voice. For indeed among men, those who are prone to epileptic fits emit, when they speak, a voice resembling a bleat. As for the dog, it perhaps shares less in lechery and foul odor, though some say that no dog sets foot on the Athenian Acropolis nor on the island of Delos, because of its open mating, just as oxen, pigs, and horses mate in enclosed places, but dogs mate openly and without restraint. But such people do not know the true reason. It is that, because the dog is a fighting animal, they exclude it from inviolable and holy sanctuaries, so as to provide suppliants a safe refuge. It is likely, then, that the priest of Jupiter, too, being himself, as it were, a living and holy image affording refuge, was to be open to those in need and to suppliants, with no one keeping them away or frightening them off. For this reason, a small couch of his stood in the entrance hall of his house, and whoever fell at his knees had, for that day, immunity from blows and punishment. And if a prisoner in bonds managed to reach him first, he was freed, and his fetters were then thrown out, not through the door, but over the roof. It would have been of no use for the priest to present himself as so gentle and humane if a dog stood guard, frightening off and driving away those who needed to take refuge. Yet the ancients did not consider the dog an altogether pure animal either. It is consecrated to none of the Olympian gods, but is sent as a dinner offering to Thonic Hecate at the crossroads, and so holds a place among things apotropaic and purificatory. At Sparta, they sacrifice puppies to Enyalius, the most murderous of the gods. Among the Boeotians, there is a public rite of purification in which they pass between the two halves of a dog cut in two, and the Romans themselves, at the Lycia, which they call the Lupercalia, sacrifice a dog in the month of purification. Hence it is not out of keeping that, for those who have taken on the service of the highest and purest of the gods, it is forbidden to keep a dog as a companion and housemate. For what reason was the priest of Jupiter forbidden even to touch ivy, or to pass along a road over which a trained vine was trailed from above? Is this like the prohibitions against eating from a stool, sitting on a grain measure, or stepping over a broom? Not that the Pythagoreans feared and guarded against these things themselves, but that under these expressions they were forbidding other things. Indeed, passing beneath a vine carried a reference to wine, implying that it was not lawful for the priest to become drunk. For over the heads of those who are drunk hangs wine, and they are weighed down and humbled by it, whereas one ought to be above this pleasure and always master of it rather than mastered by it. As for ivy, is it because, being unfruitful and useless to men, feeble and needing the support of others because of its weakness, yet bewitching most people with its shade and the sight of its greenness, they thought it should not be kept and trained about their houses to no purpose, since, clinging to the plants of the earth that support it, it is harmful to them. For this reason, it is excluded from the Olympian sanctuaries, and one would see ivy neither in the temple of Hera at Athens nor in that of Aphrodite at Thebes, but at the Agrionia and the Nyctelia, most of whose rites are performed in darkness, it is present. Or was this too a symbolic prohibition of revel bands and Bacchic rites? For women subject to Bacchic frenzy rush at once upon the ivy, tearing it apart, seizing it with their hands, and devouring it with their mouths. So that those are not entirely unpersuasive who say that ivy, possessing a spirit that rouses and stirs madness, drives people out of their senses and disturbs them, and altogether induces a wineless drunkenness and a pleasure for those who are already disposed to ecstatic frenzy. Why were these priests never permitted to seek or hold public office, yet they make use of a lictor and have an official chair as an honor and consolation for not holding office? Is it, as in some parts of Greece, that the dignity of the priesthood was held to counterbalance that of kingship, and those who failed to obtain the kingship were appointed priests instead? Or rather, is it because priests have duties that are fixed, while magistrates have duties that are irregular and undefined, so that it was not possible for the same man to be present at both when the occasions of each coincided at once? Rather, he would often have had to neglect one or the other when both pressed upon him at the same time, and so, at one moment fail in his duty to the gods, at another do harm to the citizens. Or was it that, seeing in human offices necessity attaching no less than power, and that the ruler of the people, as Hippocrates said of the physician, looks upon dreadful things and lays hands upon dreadful things, and reaps private griefs from others' misfortunes, they thought it not holy for a man to sacrifice to the gods and begin sacred rites once he had been involved in the condemnation and execution of citizens. Often, indeed, of kinsmen and intimates, as also befell Brutus.